I think coming back to this question about how do I choose my projects, I think a lot of the times there is intentionality behind choosing them, but then I think part of it is manifesting it for myself, whether it's thinking through what it is that I want, writing out a purpose statement, thinking through how to fill that purpose statement, and then telling others, that then it almost meets at the intersection of like the right place at the right time, because I've almost been subconsciously positioning myself for that opportunity.
Welcome back to Paths to Purpose. Thanks again for joining us. We have a very special guest joining us today, but before we introduce him, I wanted to take a moment to reflect on last week's episode with Monique. Even having been through this process many times, it was so helpful to hear how she kind of processed her own introspection and the questions that she asked herself. And it really resonated with me very strongly. And again, I've done this many times. And one of my friends also commented to me that she started listening to the episode. She heard that Monique was an accountant, and she thought, oh man, this is not going to be relevant for me. This is going to be boring. And then she listened to the rest of the episode and she was like, no, this is widely applicable. So we're really excited that her episode resonated with a lot of you, and that, yeah, it's not necessarily about what every single person is doing, but it's again about the process and how you kind of connect with those things. So Alan, did you have any reflections from that episode last week?
Yeah, first tell your friend that accounting is actually really interesting. It's not boring. But going back to Monique's podcast specifically, I've been teaching it for decades. Anyway, I think it's important based on Monique's comments. I mean, she really hit home on some core points that she highlighted, and I want to bring those through. So for example, specifically how powerful it is to articulate your purpose in one sentence. Like, what is your purpose in one sentence? In my experience, the most impactful projects and people are the ones where you understand exactly what they're doing in a sentence.
Yeah, I think that that's so important. And it was just so great that she could share the process that she used to get to that point and to get to that clarity that elicited that one sentence purpose statement. So this week we're going to talk about, from that purpose, choosing projects that resonate with you. And our motto on this podcast is purpose, projects, people. Alan, can you kind of explain more about why choosing projects is so integral to this process that we're covering and how it fits into the broader idea of finding a purpose-filled career?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I believe basically that it all comes back to trust and earning trust with the people who control access to the opportunities. And if we immerse in projects that we care about, particularly when nobody else would even consider doing them, that allows us to show that we have sincere commitment. Also, trust requires us to have competency, which requires immersive learning, and doing these kinds of projects will help with our learning. And so and even Monique discussed it in her last webinar, that it's important to look for projects that emotionally resonate and that offer learning. And she continually, apparently, in her introspective check-ins, keeps looking at how much learning she's doing from her projects.
Yeah, I think that that's so true. And I think our conversation today will definitely help illuminate this concept for our listeners and how important it is to choosing relevant, impactful projects to this process. We are very excited to have another guest with us this week, Marco Dorado. Marco is currently the Colorado State Director of the All on the Line Project, which is a national campaign to address political manipulation of voting district boundaries. He was previously an assistant field director for the National Development Council and a business operations manager for the Latino Leadership Institute. Marco, welcome to Paths to Purpose, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Danielle. I'm really excited to be joining you today and to just share a little bit about sort of my trajectory and my background.
We're so excited to have you. Can you kind of start there and talk more broadly about what you do currently and how you got there?
Yeah, so currently, as you mentioned, I'm the Colorado State Director with the All on the Line campaign. And the way that I got to this point is actually a really interesting story, a really funny story. I worked on redistricting 10 years ago in Colorado as an intern at the Colorado Latino Leadership Advocacy and Research Organization. And at that point, I was a freshman. It was the summer after my freshman year of college. I actually wasn't sure if I was going to be going back to college because at that point I didn't have enough money to pay for school. And we can get into this later on in the podcast about the pretty precarious situation that I was in. But I ended up interning for GLADO, and we were working on redistricting to make sure that the voice of Colorado's Latino community was maximized as part of the 2011 redistricting process. And so that was just, as a 19-year-old, one of the most eye-opening experiences that I could have had in any type of internship, because it really made me understand the fundamental importance of the redistricting process, both at the federal level, also at the state level, because the state also does redistricting, its reapportionment, and really what that means for the way that we're able to exercise our democratic right for voting, and then what then that vote means in terms of the policies that are created or aren't created that both benefit us or don't benefit voters in our democratic system. And so really, I've been working on redistricting since 2011. In the interim, however, I haven't really been doing redistricting because it's once in a decade process. And so getting to this point has been a tapestry of, I think, different projects, experiences, that culminated really last year with getting my master's in public administration from the University of Washington, and working in community economic development for about a year and 6 months once everything was said and done before transitioning to my current role. But really, when the opportunity came around to be the Colorado State Director and work on redistricting in Colorado, where the process is now going to be taking place with two independent commissions outside of the hands of politicians, it's such an important opportunity and a once in a decade opportunity to really do my part at making sure that our voices are heard and exercising this transparent process that we're now using in Colorado.
That is phenomenal. Can you kind of describe what your purpose is then, maybe in a one sentence overview, and kind of what inspired it? And do you have any tools that you use to help you kind of get to this point?
Yeah, I think the way that I would describe my purpose, and this might sound a little bit scripted because I've actually thought about it a lot, and I think it's what I used to drive the reason why I went to graduate school, right? Which is this idea or this commitment to policies, strategies, initiatives, programs that help strengthen communities. And I really carried that with me since before graduate school. And I carried it, I know for a fact that I carried it with me in graduate school, because I remember being in a class where one of our professors asked us, what is our purpose? And that was my response. And the reason that I think I came up with that as my purpose is because it's really, again, rooted in, if you just, in just thinking about it, right? Rooted in how do we strengthen communities? And that I think is a reflection of my upbringing and the community that I come from, and understanding that the community that I come from is a community that is full of a lot of people with a lot of heart who are really hard workers, but a lot of time are excluded from a lot of opportunity because of our immigration status, because of the color of our skin, because we don't have enough money. And so when thinking about my purpose, it's really rooted in that, and really rooted in understanding that the community that I come from, I shouldn't be an exception of that, right? And how do we make sure that a person like me isn't the exception of folks that come from my community? And that's making sure that all communities are as strong as they can be. And again, playing my role in making sure that we're able to get to that point. And I think that the tools that I used really to arrive at this sort of purpose that I've set for myself, the first two tools that I can think of, one, the first one being sort of introspection, right? And a lot of making sure that in what I plan to do for myself and this purpose that I set out for myself is, again, and I think I described this, right? Really rooted in an understanding and reflection of what it is that I want to do for myself, what it is that I want to do for others, because I think I have an inherent sort of desire to do good for others and do good for the public good. And really then trying to understand what is that connection, right? Between what really motivates me and what is the public good that I want to make. I think the second tool that I ended up using to arrive at this purpose is coupled with that reflection. And the tool is my education. One of my favorite quotes is a quote by Adlai Stevenson, who was JFK's ambassador to the UN. And in his quote, he says that the power and the privilege of our education is that no matter, and I'm paraphrasing at this point, but no matter what we decide, because of the privilege of our education and the power of our education, we're going to be the pace setters of social, political, and economic thought in our communities, regardless of if we want that responsibility or not. Right. And so I reflected a lot on the power and the privilege of my education and how that has to play a role in the purpose that I've set for myself. Again, coming back to this idea that because I come from a community, I come from a family, right, where I'm the only person who so far has graduated from college. And while I think that speaks to a lot of the hard work that I've done, I also think that that speaks to the systemic failures that people in my family, people in my community have to live with. And so I want to do my part to address some of those so that I'm not an exception, but rather commonplace in my community.
So Marco, this is Alan. Thank you for sharing that. And I want to, again, thank you for coming and joining us, but also for giving us a purpose statement in a sentence, which I constantly tell students to try to get to, because I think getting that clarity is extremely helpful. But with that purpose, you can have so many different projects to select from. How did you choose the ones you're engaged in, and how do you assess the learning from them?
Yeah, so coming from my purpose statement, the way that I really thought about the way that I wanted to go about my work, and again, this a lot of times comes back to like right before I decided to go to graduate school, because I think there was a phase of figuring out what exactly it is that I wanted to be doing after I graduated from undergrad from CU in 2014. And I think where I arrived was once I understood what my purpose was, I understood then what are the levers or what are the mechanisms that I can sort of use to arrive at, to fulfill that purpose, right? And so one of the things that I really started thinking about, right, was, well, how do we strengthen communities? And one of the things, I think bringing it back to my reflection and kind of the community I want to help strengthen and improve is understanding kind of what is the root of the problem. And the root of the problem that I've sort of identified is a lack of access to opportunity, right? Whether that's economic opportunity, social opportunity, political opportunity, economic opportunity, whatever the opportunity is, educational opportunity. I really saw that as being a big barrier. And I connected that right back to the reason why we need to strengthen communities, right? Because we need to strengthen communities because in order to be stronger, we need to be able to have access to the opportunities that other communities have access to. And so really kind of thinking about it from the context of, from this view of how do we broaden opportunity, regardless of what that is, has really helped guide the work that I've done, especially over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And so most recently, I would say before I started my current role, when I was in graduate school, I really wanted to figure out and really wanted to focus on how do we increase access to economic opportunity, right? Even though I was getting a master's in public administration with an emphasis in social policy, I think social policy and economic opportunity are inextricably intertwined, right? And so I wanted to find, I wasn't going to find the answer, but I wanted to better understand how do you tie economic opportunity? How do you better understand access to economic opportunity? And it was almost like by virtue of putting it out into the world, it kind of just ended up happening, right? I was in, I don't even remember where I was, but it was the summer before my second year of graduate school that I got an email from my professor saying, hey, there's an alumni that works at the National Development Council. They work on community economic development. Is this something that you would be interested in? And as soon as she sort of mentioned it, I jumped on it. I did my interview with the woman who ended up hiring me. And that really allowed me to think about and work in economic development for a year and 6 months, right? Between for my last year of graduate school and then the last 6 months of 2020, and really figuring out what are the mechanisms that exist in the private, public, and nonprofit sectors to really spur economic opportunity and economic development that leads to economic opportunity. And so I think coming back to this question about how do I choose my projects, I think a lot of the times there is intentionality behind choosing them, but then I think part of it is manifesting it for myself, whether it's thinking through what it is that I want, writing out a purpose statement, thinking through how to fill that purpose statement, and then telling others, that then it almost meets at the intersection of like the right place at the right time, because I've almost been subconsciously positioning myself for that opportunity. And so that's one example that I can think of right off the top of my head.
Well, I think the telling others is key too, because they're going to try to match you into some of them. So I think that's actually important, but it does stem from the clarity of purpose. There's no question from what I've heard, from what you've said, from what I've heard you tell us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, I don't know if it's because I was already thinking about this when I wanted to pursue graduate school, but once I had that clarity of purpose, it's almost like the projects and the roles that I feel really fulfilled by have sort of just, I found them and they found me in a very, very natural, organic way. That has really helped me then, like, for example, this more current role that I'm in now, right? Something that I did 10 years ago that now I've become very passionate about. Again, was something that kind of just found me, that I wasn't necessarily looking to leave my last role, but when this opportunity came up because of the purpose and the work I wanted to do and the previous experience having done it, it was very easy and a natural fit to take it over.
Well, just to follow up to you on that, I mean, what we talk about is that people find people. And so it's the projects with the people who found you. So it's a matching on people, which is really, because jobs don't find anything. People in the jobs do. And so I think that's really what's going on here, which actually illustrates the whole point of this podcast. So thank you for bringing that out.
Yeah, of course, of course. I will say that the role I'm in now, that I work with the woman who I worked with 10 years ago on redistricting, which has been a great way to sort of like come back together and do this work. And we made a joke when I started that we're back in the trenches, right? But it's that making that connection that brought me back, the connection 10 years ago that brought me back to doing this work now.
I'm just so inspired by you telling your story. But on top of that, you have a really interesting background too. So you're a dreamer. Can you kind of explain what that status means and what the implications are for you personally and how that's kind of shaped your whole purpose and been a part of your story?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I am a dreamer, and really what that means, is that when I was a child, my family came to the United States from Mexico and came to the United States, overstayed our visas. And so effectively what that means is that I'm an undocumented immigrant. My family are undocumented immigrants. And so I actually never understood what that actually meant until I was a sophomore in high school, right? I came to the United States when I was 2 years old. And so I've lived here since 1995. And so for all intents and purposes, I've grown up in this country as American as you can be, right? And so it wasn't until I was a sophomore in high school that I realized like what it meant to not have a social security number. Like I knew I didn't have a social security number. I knew that I couldn't get a driver's license. I knew that I couldn't get a job, but I didn't know what that meant, right? I didn't know in a deeper sense, what all of those things meant until I was in high school and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do to go to college. And so when I was in high school, I was in the International Baccalaureate program, and the whole point of the program was to get students prepared to go to college. And so I recall when I was applying to be in this program, my mom told me, you know, you don't have a social security number, you probably can't do this. And at that point, it was still sort of an abstract, like, what is this reason that I can't do something? But then I started to slowly realize that at that time in Colorado, not having a social security number and being an undocumented immigrant, on top of not being able to get a job and legally work, not getting a driver's license, also meant that in order to go to college, I would have to pay out-of-state tuition at the University of Colorado, because law at that time meant that undocumented students, regardless of the fact that we've lived in Colorado our whole lives, our families paid taxes in Colorado our whole lives, we couldn't access in-state tuition because of our undocumented status. And so what then that has led to is actually, I think that has actually led to a lot of like the reason why I am so driven to fulfill the purpose that I've identified for myself, is because over the course of the last now 15 years, right, from when I was in high school telling someone that I'm undocumented to now, things have changed drastically, and things have changed drastically because of people leveraging their voice, conducting advocacy around this issue, and making sure that, people know that we are not some abstract being. We're actually like your friends, your neighbors, your classmates, your colleagues, your students. And so in 2013, the Obama administration announced Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which basically meant that people like myself who came to this country as kids who are undocumented can access one, a work permit and a social security number, and basically deferred deportation every 2 years. So what happens is every 2 years, I go to the USCIS field office, give them my fingerprints, give them $500. They run a background check and they say, okay, great, we won't deport you for 2 years and you can continue working for 2 years. And so really what that has meant, I share that with you because what that has meant is that it has opened the floodgates of opportunity for someone like myself, right? Someone who, as I mentioned earlier, grew up in this country, as American as they come, really priming myself for whatever opportunities came my way. And once DACA became accessible, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, it opened the floodgates of opportunity, right? Because I was able, I think I got DACA when I was the spring of my junior year at CU, right? And so up until that point, I wasn't able to do any internships. The internships I did were free, right? Like I wasn't getting paid for them. And most of them, I couldn't do them in any corporate roles, even though I was a business minor, a business major. And so a lot of the internships that I did were at community-based organizations where the work was free. It was basically volunteer work. But the minute that I got my Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, I interned at the state capitol. I ran and was elected student body president at CU for the student government. And then after that, I was able to then sort of start my professional trajectory in a very similar manner to the rest of my classmates, right? And so that has really led me to the point where I am today, both on a professional and a personal and a professional sense of personally doing as much advocacy and work as I can, right, to ensure that access to these opportunities aren't limited to me. And then on a professional sense, and I think my most current role speaks to that, right, understanding that the way that we're able to elect people to represent us has fundamental impact on the policies that then are passed and created that impact so many communities in so many ways.
So that's an incredible story. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, of the U.S. Congress has spoken about your story. And a lot of our listeners are asking all of our speakers about imposter syndrome. Do you deal with imposter syndrome? How does it show up? How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I think that I deal with imposter syndrome probably every single day that I'm at work or that I'm not at work, right? And I think that imposter syndrome is one of those things that it's so hard to overcome. And especially, right, when you think of coming from a low-income background, my parents have never went to college. My parents didn't graduate from high school. And so a lot of the spaces that I'm walking into, I am walking into spaces where I don't see myself reflected in the other people. And so it creates a lot of second guessing and questioning. Am I the right person for this? Am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to say the wrong thing? Do I even belong here, right? And so I think that the way that I deal with imposter syndrome is two ways. I think in the most like tangible way is making sure that for everything that I do, I'm overprepared, right? Which is, I think, a reaction, a natural reaction to like the anxiety that is caused by imposter syndrome. I think the second piece of dealing with imposter syndrome for me is this very slow realization, because I think probably the imposter syndrome hit the worst at the beginning of grad school for me, either in the projects that I was working on or even just being in graduate school. But one of the things that I slowly and more clearly began to realize that outside of like the hard skills that you need to do a certain job, right? Whether that's being an accountant, that's being investment banker, whether that's being a consultant, whatever, there's certain hard skills that you need to get the job done. But then there's another set of skills that aren't as hard that you really have to be able to lean into in order to be effective in those roles. And I think that for me, what that boils down to, and it's one of my favorite analogies to use, is that a lot of folks, especially a lot of folks in leadership roles, right? Outside, separate from those hard skills, really what they're doing is they're building a plane while they're flying it, right? And that's my favorite type of role to work in ambiguous roles where we don't really know the answer yet. We know where we want to go and we have the tools to get there, but we don't necessarily have the answer about how we're going to get there yet. And so one of the ways that I try to overcome imposter syndrome for myself is reminding myself that, well, I'm building a plane while I'm flying it, and so are so many other people. And so how can that shift my mindset in thinking about, do I belong here? Am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to say the wrong thing? And flipping that to, well, we're all on the same plane. Right? And we're thinking about these planes in a very similar manner. Let me lean into that. So then that way I can sort of put myself at ease with my imposter syndrome to a certain extent and not feel like I don't belong, or I'm going to say the wrong thing, or I just am not qualified to be here.
Where did you get that courage? Because a lot of the students with whom I worked in business schools are highly risk averse, and there's a lot of job opportunities where they don't have to take on the risks that you're taking on. And yet you just described that you enjoy it. So How does that process for you? What's the catalyst for your ability to do that?
Yeah, I think ultimately for me, the catalyst in order to be able to sort of overcome imposter syndrome and take on some of these risks ends up being that in order to be in a leadership position, in order to really be able to catalyze change and be the one that's catalyzing that change, whether it's you or with a team, right? Like, you really need to be comfortable understanding that you're not going to have all the answers, and it's okay not to have all the answers. I think what it is important though to have is the ability to bounce back from either making a mistake or not having those answers. And I think for me, I think it was a process of developing that and getting to that point. But I think that finding projects, especially those that I care so much about, that sort of that outweighed any fear or any risk aversion that I had. Because I think of, for example, this project that I'm on now with redistricting, I actually think back to my last project before I left my last role. I'd never administered small business relief programs that were statewide in nature and in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And I remember sitting, talking to my partner about it and saying, I don't know why I have imposter syndrome when nobody ever taught me how to do this, but yet here we are. And my colleagues have entrusted me with this. And that's because I really want to make sure that businesses in my community can bounce back from the economic fallout of COVID-19, right? And so I think it's marrying passion, purpose, and having that outweigh this fear or risk aversion that we might have.
I think you just articulated the entire reason why we're doing this podcast. So thank you. Yeah, we're done. It's great. One question that I was really curious to hear from you was just kind of, you just kind of described a lot about uncertainty and kind of ambiguity in roles, but also I think it sounds like in your life, you've had to deal with a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity in how your status is going to affect your employment opportunities and things like that. Do you have any ways that you have found that have helped you cope and just continue to be this just really inspiring person that continues to work on these projects that you really care about, despite, you know, things that are completely out of your control?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the biggest things that's helped me, I think personally and professionally, to be honest with you, is first and foremost, I think like finding people who are like-minded in a similar situation. And I think that's where, like, as an undocumented person in America, it actually has been very easy to find people in this position, right? Who then we then can become our own each other's cheerleaders, right? When it comes to, well, I very much understand what you're going through, right? So even having to have a conversation about the nuances of being undocumented, that's not even a question, right? Because we're starting off at the same point. Then it gets to, I understand that, let's say, for example, you feel uncomfortable with imposter syndrome because no one in your family has ever been in this type of role. Well, I have someone that then I can lean on, that I can sort of share experiences with, brainstorm, really call them like thought partners, and sort of, it's almost like accountability buddies, but it's not even accountability at that point anymore, because the purpose isn't accountability. It's actually, it's kind of like my hype people, right? Find your hype people that, one, you can hype and they can also hype you. Because I think really what that has done for me is created a sense of reassurance with people who obviously are friends, loved ones, but also very similar to who I am and where I come from. So there's a degree of understanding there. I think in addition to that, right, I think creating space for myself to be reflective, but also to give myself the grace of understanding that I'm not always going to have answers for things. I'm not always going to do things correctly, but I'm willing to give myself the time, the space, and the grace to say, you know what? You gave it a fair shot. It's fine if it didn't work out the way it was intended to work out in the first place. What are you going to do next to sort of get right back up, right? And that to me ends up looking like giving myself the time to go on walks, giving myself the time to go on runs, and really giving myself that time, that mental space to process kind of what is it that I'm doing and what is it that I need to do to feel as best as possible as I'm doing it.
So if you have a minute, I'm going to ask a question that we typically ask students when we're starting them off to try to find emotional resonance. And this is sort of the starter kit, one of the starter kits. And so I wanted to try it out on you if you're willing to give it a go.
Yeah.
And that is, when was the last time you lost track of time because you were so immersed in something?
Yeah, the last time I lost track of time, I can actually recall it was either January 1st or January 2nd. So I wasn't working and I had just woken up and I saw that people had started getting their stimulus checks. And one of the things that really, that I was really reflective on was how privileged I have felt, privileged and fortunate I'd felt for the last year, right? Because I hadn't lost my job because of COVID. I was still working. I graduated my master's. If anything, I got a new job and I was in no way impacted financially by the pandemic. And so the project that I ended up picking up, and this was actually a project outside of work. It was more of a personal endeavor that I ended up doing with one of my close friends and colleagues is I texted her and I said, look, stimulus checks are coming out. And in December, a court basically said that the DACA program, which I'm a beneficiary of, that gives me the ability to legally work in this country. The program had been rescinded by the previous administration, but a court basically reinstated the program in December. And so I texted her and I said, hey, you know what I think we should do is maybe we should reach out to our family and to our network and say, hey, we know folks are getting stimulus checks. We're committing to donating our stimulus check to fund one $500 fee for a first-time applicant, kids who are in a very similar position that I was in 10 years ago, right? Let's help these kids access opportunity by simply allowing them the financial ability to pay for their first-time DACA application. And so I think this was a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning. I think it was a Saturday morning. It was on one of the first days of the year. And basically what we ended up doing is we ended up setting up the entire infrastructure of how are we going to reach out to family and friends? How are we going to collect pledges? And then that ended up evolving to, we partnered with a fiscal sponsor to make their pledges go through a fiscal sponsor. And so the pledges and the donations were tax deductible, to then identifying folks who were first time DACA applicants, and then also identifying legal support for them to help put together their application, because a lot of times it requires legal help. And so what that ended up resulting in is we ended up raising, I believe, enough money to fund 30 applications, so 30 times $500. And then we ended up partnering with our fiscal sponsor, the nonprofit M-Schools, who basically did all of the processing of funds, both accepting the money and then dispersing it to the people who we supported. And then we also actually ended up partnering with the University of Colorado Law School Immigration Legal Clinic, who we would send folks to them for legal help applying for DACA. And we actually also provided them with funds for 5 DACA applications. And so I share that project, right? Because it was one of these things where I remember it being the first of the year. I remember it being like a Saturday or Sunday morning, but it went from one morning idea to Sunday evening actually being realized. And I think that the reason why I lost track and why it was just sort of like such a natural sort of project to pick up and do on my free time outside of work, one was because of this really deep commitment to paying it forward and making sure that whatever I can do and what is in my power that I can do, I do it. Understanding that I want to give back to my community, and then realizing that over the last 10 years, I have made connections with so many different people across so many different segments of my life, but also of sectors, whether it's the nonprofit world, the legal world, the private sector, that what a great opportunity and what a great cause to sort of thread a needle and connect some dots and say, hey, let's put our collective resources to good use to really help impact the lives of 30 people in our community.
Besides being really super inspiring and actually very impactful, one of the things that I actually love about that particular narrative is that it actually illustrates the entire concept. If you have a passionate interest, if you have a single sentence purpose statement, you can collect a team of people who are equally committed and you can build infrastructure quickly. And you can lose in it and you can make real impact very quickly. And that's exactly what this podcast is about. I thank you for sharing that.
Well, and one of the things that I will share, coming back to this idea of like building a plane as you're flying in ambiguity, right? Like we went into it thinking, okay, we'll raise $1,000, give 2 kids DACA funds for their DACA application. When it got to the point that we realized we were going to be raising over $10,000, there was no way we were going to manage this on Venmo. And I remember kind of slightly thinking, what are we going to do to process all this money? How are we going to send it out? How are we going to like make sure people know that we're being accountable to the money they're giving us as well? And so that was a lot of leaning into like, we're building this plan as we're flying it. We're going to find those resources and we're going to get it done. let's just lean into it and do it because we're going to get it done. We're going to get it done.
I just am so inspired by you. Thank you so much for sharing your story today and just for being so authentic and vulnerable about your journey of finding purpose and also just being a huge, I would imagine, inspiration in your own community, but also for other people that will be listening to this podcast. I wanted to ask if you wanted to share any social media or ways that people can kind of hear more about you and what you do for our listeners.
Yeah, I'll say that I'm probably the most active sort of in sharing what I do on Twitter. And my handle is at @ElMarco_Antonio, at @ElMarco_Antonio. And that's really kind of where I share a lot about the immigration advocacy work that I've done and continue to do, where I share a lot about the work that I'm doing currently at All on the Line, and really a place where I share a lot of the resources that are available in the community in Colorado specifically.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And I'm sure you'll be having some new followers after this. So thank you.
Wonderful. No, thank you so much, Danielle and Ellen, for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. Remember, if you want to continue to work through some of the questions that we talked about today, also an introspective guide from Monique Malcolm-Hay from last week, head over to our Instagram at @paths2purposepod. And we will be posting those there. If you have questions or feedback, again, our email is paths2purposepod@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week. Thanks.